Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. This is a regular podcast where we talk about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem blogger, but now I'm an independent. And joining me today, I'm delighted to say, is Jessica Asato, who is Labour PPC for Norwich North and also chair of the Fabians. Good evening, Jess.
Hi there, Mark.
Hi. And also, I'm delighted to say, we're joined by Mark Pack, who is Lib Dem blogger and commentator, and also author of 101 Ways to Win an Election. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. It's going to get confusing with the whole Mark thing. Hopefully, we'll know which one you're talking to, Jess, when you inevitably say Mark and the wrong one answers. But
well, I might say Mark T and Mark P. How about that?
Yeah, you could just call us by our surnames, Pack and Thompson. You know,
oh, no.
We don't mind.
That sounds a bit public school to me.
Yes, it does, actually.
Makes us sound like a slightly dodgy law firm, doesn't it?
Yeah, Dewey, Cheatham and Howe. OK, right. So the first thing we can't avoid talking about is the whole Maria Miller thing, which finally came to its pretty much inevitable conclusion this week. I know that Emma, when she did the podcast last week, did talk about this. But now that we know how it ended, I think we do need to go through the gory details. So basically, Maria Miller was accused of various issues to do with her expenses, and she was actually found to have overclaimed, and she was told to pay back, I think, £45,000. But then a Commons committee consisting of 10 members of Parliament then decided she only needed to pay back, I think it was £5,800. But there was just a lot of controversy about this, and it dragged on and on and on. And in the end, she felt like she had no option but to resign. And there seemed to be a fair bit of pushing behind the scenes, I suspect, in this. Mark, do you want to start us off? What do you think about this? And also, what do you think about the potential consequences of this? Do you think this makes it more likely that some kind of parliamentary recall will be brought in? Because it does seem like there's quite a lot of ill feeling on the ground in Basingstoke as well, where she's the MP for.
I mean, in a way, you could say that the Maria Miller case demonstrates why recall often isn't needed, because there was a fuss, there was lots of coverage, she ended up resigning. It took a few days to happen, but frankly, it happened a lot quicker than it would have happened if there was a recall mechanism. So I think, you know, there are some good arguments in favour of recall. I'm quite keen on the idea, but actually a case where a minister ends up resigning is probably not the best of examples to use as to why recall might be useful. What struck me particularly, though, about the case was the way that the ruling against her, you know, how much she had to repay, the way when the MPs then sat in judgment and they reduced that sum, they actually had reasonable grounds for reducing the sum in terms of reviewing the evidence, having extra evidence that the independent commissioner hadn't previously had access to, and therefore make a decision based on that. And yeah, you have extra evidence, you come up with a different view. That's a perfectly reasonable approach generally in life. But the way that got just absolutely no traction at all with the public or with the media, I think shows what a huge problem the whole parliamentary expenses system has in terms of almost complete lack of credibility with the public.
But just to pick you up on the recall point, because you are right. I mean, the story seemed to follow Alistair Campbell's famous 11-day rule. I think it was either on day 10 or day 11 when she finally, resigned effectively. But she's still an MP, and a recall mechanism would be threatening her position as a Member of Parliament now. As it is, she's going to remain a Member of Parliament, and I think Basingstoke is a reasonably safe seat. I mean, I understand there's some mobilisation on the ground for some kind of, campaign to try and get her kicked out, but I think we know generally how those sort of campaigns against MPs tend to go, kind of decapitation strategies very rarely work. So wouldn't you agree that there's still an argument for recall in terms of whether or not someone should still be a Member of Parliament?
I think there is a role for recall, certainly. I mean, you know, if I was an MP and voting on sort of recall in principle, I'd certainly vote in favour of it. I just think it, you know, you have to be quite careful in making that judgment, in deciding what you think the purpose of recall is, because after all, you know, the public will be getting to vote on Maria Miller's fate at a general election next year. As you say, it might be that because it's traditionally quite a conservative seat that she gets sort of re-elected, but yeah, in a democracy, one shouldn't be too hard on the public deciding to vote in favour of somebody, even if you think the result should have been different. I think the real value of recall is twofold. One is if there's something that happens, say, very much at the beginning of a fixed term parliament, where you might say, well, hang on a minute, this person's going to end up still being an MP for another 4 or 5 years. Or actually, it gives the MP the ability, if they think they've got a really good case, to take it to the public and in that sense, clear their name by saying, right, OK, I'm going to put my name on the line. Risky move, but it's the sort of move that also could clear your reputation in a way that otherwise you might be dragged down forever by more and more press stories.
You could maybe call that the John Major strategy, the back me or sack me.
Exactly.
Gambit that he tried in 1995, which actually worked for him, didn't it? So, Jess, what do you think about all of this then? Do you think Maria Miller was right to resign? Do you think it was inevitable?
It was absolutely inevitable, and it was the right thing to do, and she should have done it much earlier. And what I'm quite interested in is where the sort of honourable resignation has gone. I remember way back when Estelle Morris was in charge of education, and she resigned because she made a promise about education targets which she failed to meet. At the time, actually, a lot of people said, no, this is nothing to do with you. You know, please don't go. Actually, you know, a lot of the teaching profession said, you know, we understand why you're doing this, but it's not the right thing. But she felt personally committed, and so she went. And I think that a lot of the public are sort of wanting to see that sort of honour in politics come back. And I think that's why UKIP has grown to the extent that they have. They've been absolutely able to take advantage of the way that the public feels that the just politicians are totally still out of touch. And of course, all we needed was the expenses crisis to come back and remind them of that. I think that actually recall is something that in the end will also be inevitable, because the public doesn't feel that MPs should sit in judgment of other MPs where they have done something wrong. And for all the rights and wrongs, Mark Pack, you know, the fact is that in the public's eyes, this idea that MPs are sort of letting somebody off scot-free, even if that was the right decision with the evidence in front of them, means that their trust in the system is necessarily going to be undermined. So, you know, I think that what the government should be doing is looking very hard at the coalition agreement and the fact that they, you know, did have a process of the recall bill that was shelved earlier this year. There is still time, I think, to get it into the Queen's speech and at least sort of going through Parliament, even if it won't necessarily be through by 2015, and perhaps to seek all party consensus on this. One of those issues that prior to sort of 2010, when I was working at Progress, we believe that actually a whole package of constitutional measures, including recall, electoral reform, House of Lords reform, should actually be put to the public in a citizens' convention, taking the whole notion of these things out of Parliament, whereby most people think that turkeys don't vote for Christmas, and therefore MPs are not in the way the right body to be determining what should happen with mechanisms that ought to be with the public. So I'm quite interested to see what happens in the debate going forward, and I think this is one of the moments where politicians need to be bold and say, you know, clearly this saga continues. The only way we can really change this is by putting power in the hands of people.
Do you want to come back in on that, Mark?
Yeah, just to pick up on Jess's point about honourable resignations, I guess the most recent one that does fall into that category is Mark Harper. And ironically, I mean, who knows to what extent it was principled and to what extent it was sort of self-interest that
Can you just remind us what that was about?
He was sort of caught out with introducing legislation in Parliament to crack down on employment of illegal immigrants. And it turned out he was employing somebody where he hadn't done all the checks that he was insisting the rest of the country should have to carry out. And by resigning very quickly, you know, by the moment he sort of discovered there was a problem, getting the evidence double checked, then going public straight away and saying, and therefore I'm resigning, I think he's actually done his future political career a whole world of good. He's obviously going to stay out of government until the next general election, but whenever the Tories are next in power, whether it's after 2015 or in a later parliament, I think it's exceedingly likely that he will return to the government in a way that Maria Miller's career probably is over and done with, you know, even if she continues as an MP.
That's the thing that struck me about this. If Maria Miller had resigned pretty quickly, you know, maybe when it started to become clear to a lot of, you know, the political commentary that the writing was really on the wall for this, if she'd have kind of slightly preempted that and just gone earlier, then maybe after the next election she could come back. It really feels now to me like she is politically dead in the water. She may even stand down herself as an MP if she realises that, you know, there is no future in kind of frontline politics for her, because it's just gone too far and the expenses issue was so toxic. I mean, I agree with you, Mark. I don't know all the details and all the nuance of this, but I do understand that the MPs committee did have further information. And actually, And I've seen some reasonably fair-minded commentators actually say they were right to reduce it. You know, it was almost like an appeals process, and they were right to reduce the amount. But that is not how it came across. It came across as if MPs were stitching up the system to help one of their own in the hope that that might be reciprocated for them at some point in the future. It all just looks like funny handshakes and, you know, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And yet with the expenses issue, I mean, we all saw 5 years ago just how, you know, nuclear that went. It really feels like she's done herself no favours in that respect. I mean, and her apology was absolutely pathetic. Mm. I mean, my wife, who is not interested in politics at all, really, really not interested, you know. That's one of the reasons I got into political blogging in the first place, just to have a different conduit for my political output. Let's put it that way. But she was incensed by, you know, what happened with Maria Miller, and you know, she kept following the story. She kept saying, "Hasn't she resigned yet? Hasn't she resigned?" It's like, you know, if it's getting to the point where my wife is commentating on an issue like that, then you know it's reached the mainstream. And I just don't think she will ever wash off the tarnish that, you know, that this scandal has put on her. As a little segue from this, though, Maria Miller's replacement as Culture Secretary is the Tory MP Sajid Javid, who has an interesting background. He is the son of an immigrant who came here in, I think, the early 60s with nothing, built himself up. I think he became a bus driver in Rochdale, but he did well enough that he was able to, you know, get his kids sent to, you know, school and then university. And then Sajid ended up becoming, I think, an investment banker and earned lots of money. And at the absolute height of his career, when he was earning, I think, £3 million a year plus, he jacked it all in to become a member of parliament, earning £65,000 a year, which I think is quite an interesting kind of, you know, rags to riches background type story. But Michael Rosen, who I think is a poet, wrote an interesting piece earlier this week in The Guardian, basically having a pop but Sajid for having been a banker and not really knowing much about culture. It all seemed a bit mean-spirited to me. Mark, because I think you mentioned you'd quite like to talk about this. What did you think of Rosen's intervention? Do you think it's fair enough for him to point out that Sajid doesn't really have a background in culture?
Well, T.S. Eliot was a banker, and, you know, T.S. Eliot knew a thing or two about culture and a thing or two about poetry. And, you know, if you look at Rosen's piece, it was, I just thought, shockingly badly argued. You know, he started off with saying, well, I've looked at, you know, the new Secretary of State's Wikipedia entry and one other blog post about him online and have decided he doesn't really know anything about culture. So for somebody who was a children's poet and, you know, one would have hoped previously taking a big role encouraging good education for children to indulge in such superficial research didn't exactly warm me to the subject from the beginning. But also, if you think about it a little bit more closely, it was really odd that Michael Rosen made so much in his piece about how, you know, the new Secretary of State is a banker, he's a poet, therefore the two of them are never likely to have met, as if there is some virtue in poets isolating themselves completely from people who work in the financial sector. Now, whether you like the financial sector or not, whether you think it's too big, too small, I think one of the things almost everyone would agree on is the financial sector in all its different ways has a huge impact on modern life and modern culture. And so it's really odd, I thought, really odd for Michael Rosen to sort of essentially be arguing that anyone into culture should so isolate themselves from the modern world, lock them away, themselves away in such a high and mighty ivory tower that they never meet somebody who is part of such a major influence on modern life and modern culture. Yeah. So no, I wasn't that impressed with the piece.
It's quite interesting. It feels a little bit like, I'm going to quite an esoteric reference now, but Stephen Jay Gould's non-overlapping magisteria argument between religion and science. Jess, what do you think about this? Do you think, because Labour's response to Sajid Javid's appointment was seemed a little bit all over the place. I think Dan Hodges wrote quite an interesting and somewhat amusing. Yeah, it was quite a sarcastic piece about Labour's response.
Isn't he?
Yes, he is. That's kind of his thing, isn't it? He kind of, you know, looks at things from a quote wry perspective. But I think there was a kernel of truth in what he said, that Labour didn't really seem to quite know how to respond to his appointment.
Well, I think I agree with Mark Pack that taking a pop at somebody for not having been involved in culture before they're given a ministerial position is just quite lazy. I mean, we could probably go through lots and lots of government ministers and find that they haven't had a background in the portfolio they have. I think that's just sort of, you know, sort of a bit sad, really. What I do think, though, is that, you know, he clearly has had a few remarks that we have to raise eyebrows at. So the one that really came up was one that he made in 2011, where he said that ticket resellers are classic entrepreneurs. And, you know, that is quite a worry because, you know, I think he compared it to sort of chattering, you know, champagne socialist classes being worried about it. Actually, that's not where the worry comes from at all. It comes from session workers, incredibly poorly paid, you know, actors who aren't the glitterati, the people who do this for the love of it and are actually the heroes of our cultural sector. Those are the people who don't get the money when they're sold on. And these aren't sort of, you know, sort of entrepreneurs. These are big businesses that know that there's a market because some shows are completely in demand. So I think there's certainly a point that we can make there. But in general, the fact is that isn't culture something that everyone can enjoy, whether they're a banker or a gardener or a dustman man? I mean, you don't have to have had a background in culture to understand it and its importance to our country. So, yes, a bit of a low blow.
Actually, there's a fascinating little reflection in something you said earlier, Jess. You mentioned Estelle Morris. And actually, Estelle Morris, her background before she came into politics was in education. She had, I think, a degree in education, and she was a teacher from, I think, the early 70s right through until she entered Parliament. And one of the reasons she gave for resigning was that she just didn't feel like she was up to the job as education secretary. And yet she'd immersed herself in education for decades before she reached the heady heights of being education secretary. So that's an example showing pretty much the opposite of what Michael Rosen is arguing, that you have to have a background in the subject that you are secretary of state for.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, I don't think that we should be saying that the only people who are qualified to hold a ministerial position are those people who've had a background in that subject. Because the point is that you know, you have civil servants, you have, you know, all of your stakeholders to ensure that you're making the right decisions. You as a government minister have a very different job of steering through legislation, making sure that you're getting it right as it goes through Parliament and ensuring that you're changing the country in the way you want to. You know, I think we should give this man a chance to settle in. Obviously, I'll have criticisms of him going forward. You know, the biggest one I have is that actually the cultural sector is busy being decimated. So in a sense, talking about him and what he's going to do means very, very little to, you know, the regional theatres in Norwich and people who are seeing really beloved institutions fall by the wayside. So I'll be looking to see him championing the sector. And I'm sure a lot of people will be looking to see whether he finds any more money for it.
OK, good stuff. So we'll move on from that. And the next thing that we wanted to talk about was power and harassment in politics, which I think Douglas Carswell, there's been various talk about the subject this week, but I think Douglas Carswell, actually, just to link in slightly to what we were talking about earlier on, seemed to think that a recall mechanism would help with reducing, you know, the level of harassment that you have in politics. But I think this has been prompted by some stuff that Harriet Harman has been saying. And Jess, I know you wanted to talk about this. So do you want to fill us in from your perspective on where this has gone this week?
Well, I think so. It's been bubbling along for a while, hasn't it? And obviously there's the Lord Renard scandal. But it's something that people have known about in Westminster for a long time. Unfortunately, it is the powerless who tend to be on the hard end of this. And I've heard, you know, numerous accounts from junior researchers working very long hours, you know, for very little pay for MPs of all parties, who are treated abominably, and if it was in any other industry, you know, would be able to pursue harassment claims and probably get damages. I think one of the problems is that actually Parliament does not operate as a proper industry. So there is no, you know, power to go to an HR department. There are no disciplinary proceedings which would allow you to do it outside of the person who is your direct boss, your MP. And actually people are recruited in often very opaque ways, including working, you know, for years sometimes as unpaid interns. And getting into politics is something that still is too much about a sort of a nod and a wink, you know, understanding who the right person is to talk to. And that inevitably leads to particularly young people feeling as though they just have to put up with behaviour that, frankly, as I say, would not be tolerated in any other place. Some of that behaviour then gets into something that is sexual. And I think when you mix, you know, a lot of late night bars, you know, with subsidised booze, with the powerful people who know that, frankly, they can get away with this because nobody's going to complain, because they're going to think, where am I going to ever then get a reference from? You know, even if people want to move out of politics, you still want that reference from your boss. And there is only one boss, that's your MP. So I think we need to look long and hard at ways in which we can strengthen the voice of particularly junior researchers in Parliament. Certainly we want to, I think, bolster the strength of the unions, but having a proper HR department, I think, would be a good step.
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the just picking up on Jess's last point, the essential problem is that each MP is like their own mini small business. You know, they get given a chunk of money with which to employ staff, and then they go and sort of employ their own staff as they see fit. And I think that basic principle is a very difficult one to get away from, because MPs vary so much in terms, you know, the good MPs who do well by their staff and are hardworking themselves, they vary so much in terms of what staffing setup best suits them, the jobs they have, where their constituency are located and so on. So I think there's always been this bit of pushback from, you know, even really good MPs about saying, well, look, we've got to be given a lot of freedom in our own employment practices. I think some of the things that, again, Jess touched on that could be done, I think, you know, would be very helpful in terms of giving people a clearer route to go and raise issues, if necessary, to go through a formal complaints process and so on, that gives them a bit of sense of there's somebody who might be on their side. There's a sense of a process that gives them a bit of a say and a bit of power. So it's not purely this one-sided power play that we have at the moment, where it's the MP who holds, you know, sort of the future of their staff in their hands in terms of what reference do they give or not give and so on. And that's a very, you know, when you add that huge power imbalance to long hours, wide availability of alcohol, you can sort of see how things so often, yeah, apparently go wrong.
I mean, just have either of you kind of witnessed the sort of harassment that Harriet Harman and others have been referring to?
Well, I certainly have had, well, I've seen inappropriate behaviour, certainly by MPs with their staff. And I've also spoken to friends who feel that they've been very, very maltreated by their bosses. I think Mark Pack's right that it's, you know, you can't tar everyone with the same brush. But I've heard too many accounts now of different MPs who throw things at their employees, MPs who get them to do all sorts of tasks, including, you know, picking up presents for their kids or, you know, their dry cleaning, things that frankly, you know, feel much more like, you know, somebody who's a PA rather than somebody who might have graduated with an MA and is there to do serious policy work for somebody. And they sort of do treat people, I think, in a way that they know that, frankly, you're sort of here to do what I want. And I think there needs to be some sense that that is something that MPs cannot get away with, because the people who work for them will have a voice. I don't think that recall, actually, though, is something that would solve this, because at the end of the day, what you want to do is for these situations to be sorted out between employee and employer. Because, you know, we don't want, you know, employees feeling that the only way they can be treated properly is by going public. We need to have a system where the practice doesn't happen in the first place. So for me, recall will be a very blunt tool.
Is there a bit of a tension here, though, between what we were talking about earlier, expenses, and this? Because the more that MPs feel like they can't claim that much on expenses because, you know, it'll be on the front page of the Daily Mail and the career will be over, so that MPs become overly cautious about what they can and can't claim. And of course the rules have been clamped down on. And then on the flip side we have this whole thing about interns and, you know, people not being paid, and the consequences of the whole intern culture tends to be that it is then only, you know, the children of people who are rich or who already live in London who then end up getting the, you know, the political researcher spots, just because, you know, children from poorer backgrounds who can't afford to not take a salary for 6 months or 2 years in the centre of London just literally can't fill those spots. And Mark, do you think there is a tension between those two things? And do you think there's an answer to it?
I mean, there is a bit of a tension. I think probably not as much as you're suggesting, in that if I think of many of the people I know who have interned for MPs, you're right that the ability to do a job that's primarily based in central London is a huge sort of limiting factor in that sense. But amongst those people, and let's not forget, you know, London has a huge range of wealth in the different boroughs. Actually, you do get quite a lot of interns who are people who are not well off, not from a privileged background, and the ability to do an internship for an MP is often a key part of them sort of breaking through into the sort of career that maybe somebody who's come from a well-off background, where going to university is the automatic sort of almost not thought about thing, etc., is, you know, going to find much easier to do. So I think interns in the past have played actually quite a useful role for many people. Overall, though, it's clearly the case that there's a big problem there. And it seems to me the big mistake MPs have made, and it's really surprising given how many of them there are who are so into the sort of arts of how do you present stories to the media and so on, is calling the salaries of staff they employ expenses. Now, you wouldn't call the salary of the PA to a newspaper editor his or her expenses. It's the salary of somebody who's employed to do a job to help that organisation function. And I think, you know, the really sensible thing MPs could do is to separate out what are actually expenses in terms of the personal costs they incur in doing their job from the costs that are basically office and administrative costs that come from the fact that you need to have an office, you need to have staff, you need to have an office in the constituency, you need to be able to do things in Parliament. And that's not expenses, that's the running costs of having a democracy.
Well, I actually disagree with Mark Pack. I don't actually think that many of people who are doing internships in Parliament do come from the lowest income backgrounds. And I think Intern Aware have got some good research on this. The fact is that it is just incredibly hard to live in London and do an internship when you do not have pay. And that is happening too often, not just in Parliament, but right around, you know, both lobbying organisations, you know, charities and also, you know, think tanks. And I'm somebody who thinks that we should not have unpaid internships in Parliament at all. I think that Parliament should set up a bursary scheme so that if MPs want to hire an intern, but they cannot afford it out of their own budget, that and they get somebody who, you know, cannot pay or afford to be in London, that they should be able to apply to a parliamentary internship. I know that Hazel Blears has already done this, and a number of MPs are doing it on their own steam. But frankly, we need this across the whole of our MPs rather than just individuals. The other thing is, I think that often internships are the same as paid work. You often have to turn up in set hours. You are given set tasks. And if you don't finish them, then you'll be told you've not done the job properly. Actually, internships shouldn't be like that. They should be much more like work experience. But if you actually see a lot of interns in Parliament, they are doing the job often of a junior researcher or a junior caseworker, and that is against the law.
I mean, I just think back to when I graduated and I was looking for my first job. I mean, I wasn't in politics. It was in, you know, software development. But, you know, if my first job, let's say to break into software development, I'd have had to work for 6 months or a year or 18 months on, you know, no money, maybe with expenses for lunch and travel, but nothing else beyond that. And it had, you know, say it had to be in London. I literally wouldn't have been able to do it. I'd have had to have found a different career. It just wouldn't have been possible for me because my parents had already, you know, helped subsidise me through college and university. They weren't going to be able to do that anymore. And I've got two younger brothers and they were coming up behind me. It just wouldn't have been possible. And, you know, that's why this whole intern issue gets me really angry, because I think, you know, if I'd have wanted to get into politics back then, I mean, I don't know if it was any better, you know, 20 odd years ago when I'd have been in that position. But it really feels like the ladder's being pulled up, you know, in quite a kind of visceral way in that respect, knowing that that would have been blocked to me, not because of my skills or lack of skills, but just because my background would have meant I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Yeah, well, apparently it costs around £3,000 to be able to do a 3-month internship in London. So, you know, unless you've got family or unless you've got friends who are willing to put you up on a sofa, the fact is that some internships don't even pay transport or meals. So you really are restricting it to people who have that access. And that just cannot be fair, particularly for our democracy. I mean, this applies to the whole of the business community too. But if we're talking about Parliament, surely the people we want to be coming in, experiencing what Parliament is like and thinking about going on to work in politics, people are crying out, aren't they? I mean, Nigel Farage keeps talking about how Parliament is so distanced from ordinary people who've done ordinary jobs and come from ordinary backgrounds. Well, the reason for that, I think, is because the only way you can get into politics now is if you're wealthy.
I think if there is a parliamentary bursary scheme of the sort that Jess was talking about, I think that would definitely be a good move. I guess my sort of slight reluctance in sort of championing that too much is, you know, that will still be a set of pretty poorly paid jobs, even under, you know, a bursary scheme like that. And therefore, a lot of the issues that hold people back in terms of, particularly if they come from a long way outside London, will be ameliorated a bit if it becomes a low paid job rather than an unpaid job. But they won't suddenly be completely removed. And it seems to me part of the answer to that is by trying to have the opportunities for political type internships that are much more widely dispersed around the country. I mean, there are very few political internships, for example, related to council groups, and yet there are hundreds of town halls around the country. So even if you don't live anywhere near London, there is a council town hall near you. Lots of council groups have, in effect, full-time councillors leading the group, leading the council and so on. Lots of council groups have staff, they have offices, they have the sort of setup that could have an internship scheme go alongside it. So I think certainly bursary schemes and the like for Parliament would be a good move, but we shouldn't just look at Parliament, we should look more widely as well.
I agree with that.
I agree too. We have unanimity. Okay, let's move on from that now. The last thing that I wanted to talk about, I mean, I could go into a long preamble. Jeremy Brown has made some comments this week, and there's been quite a lot of coverage. But basically what it boils down to, Mark, what are the Lib Dems for?
Liberalism and democracy. Next.
Good. OK, thanks very much. And we'll see you next week. I think we need a bit more than that, Mark, really.
Yeah, well, I it's interesting if you look at quite a few of the issues that have been in the news recently, not the ones absolutely the top of the headlines, but the ones the sort of next notch down. I think they do show the role of the Liberal Democrats. And obviously the challenge for the party is that these are often the issues that are not quite at the forefront of the news agenda. But, you know, on issues like civil liberties and immigration and our attitude towards Europe, very often it's the Liberal Democrats sort of at one end of the spectrum and UKIP at the other end of the spectrum and Tories and Labour Party at various points in between them. So I think on quite a few of those issues, there is quite clearly a distinctive role for the Liberal Democrats. The hardest issue in a way for the party is on economic policy, because although there is a sort of distinctive liberal approach in terms of things like greater use of cooperatives and mutualism and shifting the balance of power in the economy, it's harder, I think, for the Liberal Democrats to carve that out as a really distinctive approach from, for example, parts of the Labour movement. Obviously, parts of the Labour movement have an attitude towards economic policy that's very different from that of the Liberal Democrats, but there certainly are parts which have, you know, in that respect, relatively similar views. And that's why I think issues like civil liberties and so on come up so often when people talk about the purpose of the Liberal Democrats. And the big challenge, as I said, for the party is that those are often the issues that aren't quite at the top of the political agenda.
But where, I mean, I used to be a Lib Dem, as you know, and I think most of the listeners know. And I quit the party in November last year. And it was, I mean, the reason I quit, it was fairly complicated, and I did a long rambling blog post about why, and it was to do with disillusionment with politics in general. But there were some aspects of what the Lib Dems have done, or rather haven't done, in government that did also prompt me to make the move that I did. And when you talk about civil liberties, and I think in my blog post I described it as kind of two steps forward, two steps back. You know, I mean, there were things like ID cards, you know, abolished, fine. But, you know, things like secret courts, I mean, that was, you know, as far as I'm concerned, an atrocious thing for the party to have done. And if you look at things like drugs policy, I mean, the party, I think, has a very, very good and sensible drugs policy, but none of it has ended up in the governing programme at all. If anything, it's gone in the opposite direction. They've done things like, you know, put a ban on cat, something like 200 legal highs have been made illegal, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, and I think most, from what I know of most people in the Lib Dems, they all think that that's a pretty bad thing. And yet the party just hasn't been able to exert its liberal credentials in government in the way it would have liked to have done. So doesn't that really get to the nub of the question? If when the party's in power, it can't really make that much of a difference, then doesn't the question, what are the Lib Dems for, kind of have a real resonance?
Well, I would disagree with the premise of your question, I think, on two grounds. One is that simply basically 1 in 10 of MPs in Parliament are Liberal Democrat, roughly speaking. And therefore, the degree to which you would expect the government's policies to reflect what the Liberal Democrats want rather than parties with more MPs than Liberal Democrats is always going to be limited and frustrating. But in a democracy, actually, it's right and proper that there's a good chunk of Liberal Democrat policies being introduced by the government, but it's not purely Liberal Democrat, because after all, it wasn't Liberal Democrats who came out with most MPs at the last election. And the other bit of the sort of premise of your question, I think I would disagree with, is your sort of two steps forward, two steps back approach, in that I think the, if you take, let's take the example of civil liberties, that's the one we're discussing. If you look at the overall balance of policies introduced, not just to do with ID cards, but to do with sort of DNA database, to do with extending, reintroducing the right of jury trials in complex cases, you know, there's a whole range of issues on which very significant improvements have been made to civil liberties. I agree with you, the secret courts issue is certainly highly controversial one, but you know, if you look at the overall balance, I think it's undoubtedly the case that our civil liberties are much better now than they were in 2010. Are they as many steps forward as they would be if it was a purely Liberal Democrat government? Well, no. But then, you know, the answer to that is obviously for more people to vote Liberal Democrat.
Jess, what do you think the point of the Lib Dems is? This is a slam dunk for you, surely.
Well, look, I'm somebody who, as you know, is the vice chair of the Electoral Reform Society, and I led the Labour Yes campaign for the AV referendum. So, you know, I'm somebody who believes in a consensual politics, and I think that where you have to govern as a coalition in the interest of the people, you should do. Obviously, I think that it would have been better if Labour had formed that coalition with the Lib Dems, but that's a long time ago. So let's move forward. My problem, I think, is that actually the Liberals seem to be actually split too. Now, I think that there was always a tension between what I guess were the Social Democrats and the Liberals when we had the SDP. And that seems to me to be a gap that's getting wider and wider. Listening to Jeremy Brown the other day, frankly, I didn't see why he just didn't cross the floor and join the Tories. He sounds to me like somebody who is much, much more at home with somebody like, you know, Michael Gove, for example, than he would be with many of the Lib Dem members that I know, who are frankly astounded at some of the things that the Lib Dems are supporting. We had a little flurry the other day when we thought that Tim Farron had announced a change in policy on bedroom tax. That was quickly, and unfortunately, I think, clamped down on. And there are so many things that I think people are just sort of tearing their hair out. Those Lib Dems who I think are on the more social justice wing of the party. So, you know, you could make it a division between, you know, have we done the right things on ID cards and everything else. But frankly, for the vast majority of people, those are not the important issues of the day. The important issues of the day are, is this government and coalition ensuring that the people of the country, not the richest, but those who are actually working hard and paying their taxes, are they the ones who are benefiting from the policies of this government? And I think there are too many people, particularly the vulnerable, who are really suffering for the policies that are going through. And the Lib Dems, at the end of the day, haven't achieved electoral reform. They haven't achieved recall. They haven't achieved any of the kind of constitutional reform that they wanted to as part of the coalition agreement. And I think that in the end, the kind of Liberal bit of the coalition feels to have failed completely. And I think that's a huge shame.
But hasn't Mark Pat got a point, though, Jess, when he says that the Lib Dems only have about 1 in 10, I think it's about 1 in 12 or something, of the MPs in the House of Commons. And you know, they've obviously got a pretty small minority of the MPs that actually form the government as well. That, you know, you can't expect them to exert a weight that goes above and beyond the number of MPs that they have in Parliament. And if I can just pick you up on something you said there about the constitutional reform. But let's just pick one in particular, House of Lords reform. You know, there was an opportunity there, if Labour had been willing to back the Lib Dems, that could have gone through. But actually what happened is Ed Miliband played parliamentary games and made it such that it wasn't going to be able to go through in the time and effectively scuppered it. So, you know, it's all very well for Labour to attack the Lib Dems for not having achieved stuff. But, you know, had they have backed them on that, that could have gone through. And as it was, when it came to the crunch, they weren't willing to do that.
Well, my understanding was that we could have backed it, but it was a pretty shoddy compromise anyway, as it was, in the form that it was. And it wasn't going to get through the if it had gone back to the Commons. So my feeling is that, yes, you can say that was playing with it. But the fact is that the Liberal Democrats had a historic ability to negotiate with the Conservatives in their coalition agreement to get through some things that we hitherto have been unable to achieve. And Labour wasn't able to achieve House of Lords reform in our 13 years. My problem is that having negotiated with the Tories for a whole load of things that, frankly, I don't think the public necessarily would have been particularly interested in. I certainly am, and therefore was quite interested to see how that was going to work out. But they haven't been able to achieve anything. And it doesn't matter how many MPs you have. You are the, you know, the governing coalition partner. Nick Clegg is the Deputy Prime Minister. And there are a number of Lib Dem MPs, you know, in the cabinet in senior government positions. In those positions, you do have the authority to drive through legislation, particularly where it has been negotiated as part of the governing agreement of your coalition. My problem has been that actually it seems as though the Lib Dems have been very weak in being able to do that. And that's not to do with the number of MPs. It's to do with the fact that actually the Tories have been much, much better at holding their nerve, driving through what they want.
Mark?
Well, if you look at, you know, what the Liberal Democrats have pushed very hard on, there are some significant successes. I guess the most obvious one is the £10,000 income tax allowance. You know, David Cameron notoriously in the TV leaders debate in the 2010 election said he would love to do it, but it just wasn't possible, wasn't practical. And lo and behold, it's now happened. And obviously one of, you know, not only just one of the reasons, the only reason it has happened is because that's something Liberal Democrats have pushed for very hard. There are also, you know, many things that the Tories have wanted to do that the Liberal Democrats, by pushing back very hard, have stopped. In particular, if you take an example from the workplace of the sort of fire at will policies that the Tories wanted to introduce. If you just think, going back to what we were talking before about MPs and employment practices, I mean, for all the problems we have with parliamentary sort of staff environment and so on at the moment, imagine what a complete nightmare it would be if the Tory fire at will idea had been introduced. So there have been some very significant achievements in terms of both what the Democrats have pushed through and also what they've managed to stop. I suspect in a way that at heart of the sort of disagreement about, you know, what Liberal Democrats have achieved in government, in a way, is what your starting level of expectations was. I think for a lot of Liberal Democrats, being used to year after year, government after government, basically no Liberal Democrat policies being introduced, I think, you know, people within the party pretty much view any policy that gets through, therefore, as being a bonus, a nice change from the previous 40, 50 years. It's obviously understandable that for some people who voted for the Liberal Democrats, they look at the overall set of policies the party put forward at the last election and therefore view that anything in that list that isn't achieved as being a big sort of black mark against the party. So I think that there are those two different perspectives. And obviously one thing I think the party will have to work a lot harder at getting right at the 2015 election is being clearer about this is the overall list of things we want to achieve, but being realistic, how many of them we're able to achieve depends on what the party strength is if there's a hung parliament, as opposed to simply saying, here's an overall package, sort of take it or leave it.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jess, go on.
I just wanted to respond to one thing. I mean, I think, you know, Mark Pack's analysis is interesting, I think, you know, probably for kind of political insiders. But what I think is really lacking here is what are the Lib Dems' values now? And the fact is that Mark mentioned the £10,000 allowance, but actually that's anything but progressive. In fact, George Osborne, I think, rejected some of the Lib Dems' original plan, which was to make sure that actually the raise in the threshold didn't disproportionately benefit the richest, which actually this change now does. So if you're so proud of that, you know, why? Because it doesn't do very much for the very poorest in society. I think there's something like 3 million people don't benefit from it. And the people who benefit from the most are the richest in society. So what is it about the Lib Dems now that they actually stand for? Is it about reducing the gap between rich and poor? Is it about making the market work for people rather than people who just want profit? What is government about? Is it about ensuring that the public have more say over their democracy? Or is it about a group of elite people in their ivory towers, you know, pushing down policy on people whether they want it or not? I just don't get a sense that we know what the Lib Dems stand for anymore.
Well, if you take the question about the gap between the rich and the poor, if you look at the, you know, the standard way of measuring the amount of income inequality in the country, the Gini coefficient, actually it's lower now than it was ever when Labour was in power in the last
because of the recession.
Labour government. But not at all. I think it's in part because of issues like the income tax allowance, the £10,000. It's also, though, crucially in part because of what's been done for tax at the higher end in terms of the increase, for example, in capital gains tax, in terms of the restrictions on pension tax breaks for the very richest. There's been a huge number of changes in tax at the top end, including also, although it tends to get surprisingly little talked about, the nickname of the tycoon tax, in terms of putting a limit on the maximum amount of tax breaks that the richest people can claim. There's been a huge number of changes to the tax system, which overall has made the tax system a lot fairer and a lot more progressive. So I think if you're going to take the tax system as an example of what the party's values are, you can absolutely look at what's been done over the last few years. You can absolutely look at both what the Liberal Democrats have achieved, but also what the Liberal Democrats have stopped in terms of stopping the Tories cutting inheritance tax, stopping the Tories wanting to change the tax system in a way that would have actually made it unfairer rather than fairer.
Okay, but we'll have to wrap up in a sec. But Mark, just to pick you up on that point finally, I mean, it isn't a very good sell on the doorstep, is it, to say to people, vote for us and we'll stop another party from doing things that you might not like. That's a much harder sell than vote for us and we'll do X.
Oh, definitely. Although I think one or two of the things that the Liberal Democrats have stopped will turn out to be quite powerful on the doorsteps in 2015, particularly the Tory desire to introduce fire at wheel legislation, because so many people can imagine the circumstances in which they'd have been on the worse end of that. And being sacked from a job for most people is a hugely traumatic, disruptive, dreadful experience.
OK, Jess, do you have anything else? I'm mindful that I think Mark had the first response on the first question. So do you want to finish us off?
Just very shortly. I mean, if you were to go through the gamut of rights legislation for workers that has been absolutely trounced by this government, not least now you can't actually represent yourself without paying for your own tribunal. The idea that the Lib Dems are somehow champions of workers' rights, frankly, I think is disgraceful. So, you know, I think, you know, on the doorsteps, people will be laughing at that.
Okay, I kind of feel like I should allow a further redirect, but we've pretty much run out of time. So I'd just like to thank my guests for this evening. Thanks very much to Jessica Rosato.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And also thanks to Mark Pack.
Thanks, Mark.
No problem. And I'd also like to thank Audioboo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And Nick Dennis will be here next week.